Chapter 118. Small in individual amount, still, remnants of loaves and pieces of cheese, and damp towels, and scraps of meat, and articles of wearing apparel, and mutilated crockery, and bellows without nozzles, and toasting forks without prongs, do present somewhat of an uncomfortable appearance, when they are scattered about the floor of a small apartment, which is the common sitting and sleeping room of three idle men. I suppose this can be managed somehow, apostrophe said the butcher, after a pretty long silence. What will you take to go out? Apostrophe I beg your pardon, apostrophe replied Mr. Pickwick. What did you say? I hardly understand you. Apostrophe, what will you take to be paid out? Apostrophe said the butcher. The regular chummage is 2 and 6. Will you take 3 bob? Apostrophe, and a bender, apostrophe suggested the clerical gentleman. Well, I don't mind that. It's only 2 pence a piece more, apostrophe said Mr. Martin. What do you say now? We'll pay you out for 3 and 6 pence a week. Come. Apostrophe, and stand a gallon of beer down, apostrophe chimed in Mr. Simpson. There. Apostrophe, and drink it on the spot, apostrophe said the chaplain. Now, apostrophe, I really am so wholly ignorant of the rules of this place, apostrophe returned Mr. Pickwick, that I do not yet comprehend you. Can I live anywhere else? I thought I could not. Apostrophe, at this inquiry Mr. Martin looked, with a countenance of excessive surprise, at his two friends, and then each gentleman pointed with his right thumb over his left shoulder. This action imperfectly described in words by the very feeble term of over the left, apostrophe when performed by any number of ladies or gentlemen who are accustomed to act in unison, has a very graceful and airy effect. Its expression is one of light and playful sarcasm. Can you? Apostrophe repeated Mr. Martin, with a smile of pity. Well, if I knew as little of life as that, I'd eat my hat and swallow the buckle whole, apostrophe said the clerical gentleman. So would I, apostrophe added the sporting one solemnly. After this introductory preface, the three chums informed Mr. Pickwick, in a breath, that money was, in the Fleet, just what money was out of it, that it would instantly procure him almost anything he desired, and that, supposing he had it, and had no objection to spend it, if he only signified his wish, to have a room to himself, he might take possession of one, furnished and fitted to boot, in half an hour's time. With this the parties separated, very much to their common satisfaction, Mr. Pickwick once more retracing his steps to the lodge, and the three companions adjourning to the coffee room, there to spend the 5 shillings which the clerical gentleman had, with admirable prudence and foresight, borrowed of him for the purpose. I note it. Apostrophe said Mr. Roker, with a chuckle, when Mr. Pickwick stated the object with which he had returned. Didn't I say so, Nettie? Apostrophe, the philosophical owner of the universal penknife growled an affirmative. I knowed you'd want a room for yourself, bless you. Apostrophe said Mr. Roker. Let me see. You'll want some furniture. You'll hire that of me, I suppose? That's the reglar thing. Apostrophe, with great pleasure, apostrophe replied Mr. Pickwick. There's a capital room up in the coffee room flight that belongs to a chancery prisoner, apostrophe said Mr. Roker. It'll stand you in £1 a week. I suppose you don't mind that? Apostrophe, not at all, apostrophe said Mr. Pickwick. Just step there with me, apostrophe said Roker, taking up his hat with great alacrity. The matter settled in 5 minutes. Lord! Why didn't you say at first that you was willing to come down handsome? Apostrophe, the matter was soon arranged, as the turnkey had foretold. The chancery prisoner had been there long enough to have lost his friends, fortune, home, and happiness, and to have acquired the right of having a room to himself. As he labored, however, under the inconvenience of often wanting a morsel of bread, He eagerly listened to Mr. Pickwick's proposal to rent the apartment, and readily covenanted and agreed to yield him up the sole and undisturbed possession thereof, in consideration of the weekly payment of 20 shillings, from which fund he furthermore contracted to pay out any person or persons that might be chummed upon it. As they struck the bargain, Mr. Pickwick surveyed him with a painful interest. He was a tall, gaunt, cadaverous man, in an old greatcoat and slippers, with sunken cheeks, and a restless, eager eye. His lips were bloodless, and his bones sharp and thin. God help him, the iron teeth of confinement and privation had been slowly filing him down for 20 years. And where will you live meanwhile, sir? Said Mr. Pickwick, as he laid the amount of the first week's rent, in advance, on the tottering table. The man gathered up the money with a trembling hand, and replied that he didn't know yet. He must go and see where he could move his bed to. I am afraid, sir, said Mr. Pickwick, laying his hand gently and compassionately on his arm, I am afraid you will have to live in some noisy, crowded place. Now, pray, consider this room your own when you want quiet, or when any of your friends come to see you. Interposed the man, in a voice which rattled in his throat. If I lay dead at the bottom of the deepest mine in the world, tight screwed down and soldered in my coffin, rotting in the dark and filthy ditch that drags its slime along beneath the foundations of this prison, I could not be more forgotten or unheeded than I am here. I am a dead man, dead to society, without the pity they bestow on those whose souls have passed to judgment. Friends to see me? My God! I have sunk, from the prime of life into old age, in this place, and there is not one to raise his hand above my bed, when I lie dead upon it, and say, it is a blessing he is gone. The excitement, which had cast an unwonted light over the man's face, while he spoke, subsided as he concluded. And pressing his withered hands together in a hasty and disordered manner, he shuffled from the room. Right, rather rusty, said Mr. Roker, with a smile. Ah, they're like the elephants. They feel it now and then, and it makes them wild. Having made this deeply sympathizing remark, Mr. Roker entered upon his arrangements with such expedition, that in a short time the room was furnished with a carpet, 6 chairs, a table, a sofa bedstead, a tea kettle, and various small articles, on hire, at the very reasonable rate of 7 and 20 shillings and 6 pence per week. Now, is there anything more we can do for you? Inquired Mr. Roker, looking round with great satisfaction, and gaily chinking the first week's hire in his closed fist. Why, yes, said Mr. Pickwick, who had been musing deeply for some time. Are there any people here who run on errands, and so forth? Outside, do you mean? Inquired Mr. Roker. Yes. I mean who are able to go outside. Not prisoners. Yes, there is, said Roker. There's an unfortunate devil, who has got a friend on the poor side, that's glad to do anything of that sort. He's been running odd jobs, and that, for the last 2 months. Shall I send him? If you please, rejoined Mr. Pickwick. Stay, no. The poor side, you say? I should like to see it. I'll go to him myself. The poor side of a debtor's prison is, as its name imports, that in which the most miserable and abject class of debtors are confined. A prisoner having declared upon the poor side, pays neither rent nor chummage. His fees, upon entering and leaving the jail, are reduced in amount, and he becomes entitled to a share of some small quantities of food, to provide which, a few charitable persons have, from time to time, left trifling legacies in their wills. Most of our readers will remember that, until within a very few years past, there was a kind of iron cage in the wall of the Fleet Prison, within which was posted some man of hungry looks, who, from time to time, rattled a money box, and exclaimed in a mournful voice, "Pray, remember the poor debtors. Pray, remember the poor debtors." Apostrophe the receipts of this box, when there were any, were divided among the poor prisoners, and the men on the poor side relieved each other in this degrading office. Although this custom has been abolished, and the cage is now boarded up, the miserable and destitute condition of these unhappy persons remains the same. We no longer suffer them to appeal at the prison gates to the charity and compassion of the passers-by, but we still leave unblotted the leaves of our statute book, for the reverence and admiration of succeeding ages, the just and wholesome law which declares that the sturdy felon shall be fed and clothed, and that the penniless debtor shall be left to die of starvation and nakedness. This is no fiction. Not a week passes over our head, but, in every one of our prisons for debt, some of these men must inevitably expire in the slow agonies of want, if they were not relieved by their fellow prisoners. Turning these things in his mind, as he mounted the narrow staircase at the foot of which Roker had left him, Mr. Pickwick gradually worked himself to the boiling over point, and so excited was he with his reflections on this subject, that he had burst into the room to which he had been directed, before he had any distinct recollection, either of the place in which he was, or of the object of his visit. The general aspect of the room recalled him to himself at once, but he had no sooner cast his eye on the figure of a man who was brooding over the moldy fire, than, letting his hat fall on the floor, he stood perfectly fixed and immovable with astonishment. Yes, in tattered garments, and without a coat, his common calico shirt, yellow and in rags, his hair hanging over his face, his features changed with suffering, and pinched with famine, there sat Mr. Alfred Jingle, his head resting on his hands, his eyes fixed upon the fire, and his whole appearance denoting misery and dejection. Near him, leaning listlessly against the wall, stood a strong-built countryman, flicking with a worn-out hunting whip the top boot that adorned his right foot, his left being thrust into an old slipper. Horses, dogs, and drink had brought him there, pell-mell. There was a rusty spur on the solitary boot, which he occasionally jerked into the empty air, at the same time giving the boot a smart blow, and muttering some of the sounds by which a sportsman encourages his horse. He was riding, in imagination, some desperate steeplechase at that moment. Poor wretch! He never rode a match on the swiftest animal in his costly stud, with half the speed at which he had torn along the course that ended in the Fleet. On the opposite side of the room, an old man was seated on a small wooden box, with his eyes riveted on the floor, and his face settled into an expression of the deepest and most hopeless despair. A young girl, his little granddaughter, was hanging about him, endeavoring, with a thousand childish devices, to engage his attention, but the old man neither saw nor heard her. The voice that had been music to him, and the eyes that had been light, fell coldly on his senses. His limbs were shaking with disease, and the palsy had fastened on his mind. There were two or three other men in the room, congregated in a little knot, and noiselessly talking among themselves. There was a lean and haggard woman, to a prisoner's wife, who was watering, with great solicitude, the wretched stump of a dried-up, withered plant, which, it was plain to see, could never send forth a green leaf again, too true an emblem, perhaps, of the office she had come there to discharge. Such were the objects which presented themselves to Mr. Pickwick's view, as he looked round him in amazement. The noise of someone stumbling hastily into the room roused him. Turning his eyes towards the door, they encountered the newcomer, and in him, through his rags and dirt, he recognized the familiar features of Mr. Job Trotter. Apostrophe Mr. Pickwick. Apostrophe apostrophe exclaimed Job aloud. Eh? Apostrophe apostrophe said Jingle, starting from his seat. Mr. So it is queer place strange thing serves me right very. Apostrophe Mr. Jingle thrust his hands into the place where his trousers pockets used to be, and, dropping his chin upon his breast, sank back into his chair. Mr. Pickwick was affected. The two men looked so very miserable. The sharp, involuntary glance Jingle had cast at a small piece of raw loin of mutton, which Job had brought in with him, said more of their reduced state than 2 hours' explanation could have done. Mr. Pickwick looked mildly at Jingle, and said, "I should like to speak to you in private. Will you step out for an instant?"
"Certainly,"
said Jingle, rising hastily. "Can't step far, no danger of overwalking yourself here. Spike Park grounds pretty romantic, but not extensive, open for public inspection. Family always in town. Housekeeper desperately careful, very." "You have forgotten your coat," said Mr. Pickwick, as they walked out to the staircase, and closed the door after them. "Eh?" said Jingle. "Spout dear relation Uncle Tom couldn't help but must eat, you know. Wants of nature and all that."
"What do you mean?"
"Gone, my dear sir, last coat can't help it. Lived on a pair of boots whole fortnight. Silk umbrella ivory handle weak fact honor ask Job knows it."
"Lived for 3 weeks upon a pair of boots, and a silk umbrella with an ivory handle."
Exclaimed Mr. Pickwick, who had only heard of such things in shipwrecks, or read of them in Constable's Miscellany.
"True,"
said Jingle, nodding his head. "Pawnbroker's shop duplicates here small sums mere nothing all rascals."
Said Mr. Pickwick, much relieved by this explanation. "I understand you. You have pawned your wardrobe."
"Everything jobs to all shirts gone never mind saves washing. Nothing soon lie in bed starved dying cast little bone house poor prisoner common necessaries hush it up gentlemen of the jury wardens tradesmen keep it snug natural death coroner's order workhouse funeral serve him right all over drop the curtain."
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.